Good afternoon and welcome to the January meeting of the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you today from Point Lookout on the Mid-Coast of Maine, and a particularly warm welcome to our radio audience. My name is Mac DeFord. I'm the president of the Forum, which was founded in 1983. For over 31 years, that's over 350 meetings, the Forum has been gathering on a monthly basis to hear an invited expert from the world of the Foreign Service or academia, international businessmen, journalists, talk about critical foreign policy issues facing the United States, and answer questions from our members and guests, many of whom are experts in their own right. Details about past and upcoming programs are available on our website, midcoastforum.org. Today, we're delighted to have as our speaker Hossein Mousavian. Ambassador Mousavian has been in the United States since 2009, when he left Iran after being jailed by the former president Ahmadinejad. He's currently a research scholar at the Program on Science and Global Security at Princeton. A former diplomat, he served as Iran's ambassador to Germany from 1990 to 1997. He was the head of the Foreign Relations Committee on Iran's National Security Council for 8 years after that. And as spokesman, he was spokesman for Iran in its nuclear negotiations with the European Union. Today, his topic is walking the Iran tightrope. Hossein.
Thank you very much, Mac. Good afternoon. First of all, let me to thank Mid-Coast Forum to invite me and thank you all for coming to this event, making possible for me to talk with you on Iran and the U.S. relations. About 35 years, Tehran and Washington, they have experienced the most hostile relations during the recent contemporary history of diplomacy. I have explained in details in my book, All Administrations Since 1979, in Tehran and in Washington, have tried to make diplomacy, have tried rapprochement, but they all have failed. Therefore, the big question is why the U.S. diplomacy on Iran has failed, or why Iranian diplomacy on the U.S. has failed. Today, I would talk about why the U.S. diplomacy, what's wrong with the U.S. diplomacy on Iran. This is actually the second time I'm in Maine, both time in the winter. Mac has promised me to invite me in the summer. If he invites me, then I would discuss about the other side of the coin, what is wrong with the Iranian diplomacy on the U.S. Briefly, I would like to mention seven factors why the U.S. diplomacy on Iran has failed during over three decades. The first factor is the U.S. notion or strategy of building alliance in the Middle East. You all know that the Shah was a dictator, a corrupted regime, but U.S. ally. And the revolution was against dictatorship. After the collapse of Shah, the U.S. was thinking the new government, the new system is not going to be the U.S. ally. If you are the U.S. ally, then you have carte blanche on everything, whether you are dictator or corrupted or If you are not, I'm talking at least about the Middle East. If you are not US ally, then you have problem with democracy, human rights, terrorism, everything. In 1980-81, Iran and the US signed a treaty called Algeria Treaty to resolve the US hostage problems. In this treaty, they agreed to establish normal relations based on non-interference, mutual respect. Right after the treaty was signed, the US hostages were released. The US cut the relation, diplomatic relation with Iran. And hostility exactly began from the time such a treaty was signed and the two countries, they agreed to have a very normal relations. Therefore, the US strategy of quote-unquote alliance has been one of the big problems, because always Washington has had a feeling that Iran is not its ally in the region. Whether this strategy is wrong or right, I would say look at the situation of all US allies in the region. After 30, 40, 50 years of full support for the US allies, either they have collapsed, or they are at the verge of collapse, or they are very much vulnerable. Therefore, whether really this would be right for the US to continue with such a school of thought, either to have a relation if the country is your ally or not, to consider it as a hostile, this is a question about the future of Iran-US relations. I think if the US decide to have a normal relation based on mutual respect with Iran, there would be no problem, and Iranians, they would be ready to work with the US to have a normal relations. The second problem with the US strategy is about coercion strategy. If you study the US policy on Iran, you would see continuous coercion policy. Sanctions, pressures, military strike, because during the war between Iran and Iraq, the US attacked Iran. All types of coercions which you can ever think on the earth has been implemented by the US during last 35 years on Iran. The US understanding is that if you push Iran, pressure Iran, either you would be able to change regime, or you would be able to change the behavior. At least you would be able to isolate and weaken Iran. This is the US narrative over three decades. That's why every administration has increased pressures and coercion, sanctions, by all means against Iran. But look today, I really cannot imagine any other country under so much pressure over three decades in this continent, in this world. But when you look at Middle East today, everyone understands Iran is today, after all this pressure, sanctions, Iran is one of the most powerful countries in the region, if not the most. One of the most stable countries, if not the most. And one of the most influential countries. Therefore, I would say easily that even the coercion strategy of the US has been a big mistake because it is clear it has failed after 35 years. Suddenly, Iran is one of the most powerful and stable countries in the region. You have been supposed to bring a regime change through all your pressure, sanctions. And this country, you have made it the most powerful country in the region. The third problem is about Israel. I really don't know whether Muslim countries, Muslim nations, the people in the Middle East, they are right or wrong. But overwhelming majority people in the region, they think the U.S. strategy in the Middle East is based on the interests of Israel. And the U.S. does not care about the interests of Muslim countries, Muslims, any other country. And the U.S. Middle Eastern policy has been Israelization practically over decades. And between Iran and the U.S., of course, there is a big wall of mistrust. I have explained in my book in details why Americans, they cannot trust Iran. I have a long list of the reasons for Iranian public opinion to understand why the U.S. cannot trust Iran. And the other side, I have explained why Iranians, they cannot trust the U.S., and I have a laundry list of the reasons Iranian, they cannot trust the U.S. Try to help to help Americans to understand why Iranians cannot trust the U.S. But I think there is a bigger wall other than mistrust between Iran and the U.S., and this is Israel. Blocking rapprochement, improvement, on Iran-U.S. relations. The fourth factor is the language of threat and humiliation. If you read American statements during the last 35 years, you would see 95% of the U.S. statements on Iran are very much humiliative. Very, very rarely you would find a language of respect. Every administration has chosen one title for Iran. One administration called state terrorism. One a U.S. administration called rogue state. One administration called Iran the axis of evil. Every U.S. administration has tried to find a brand for Iran, very, very nasty brands, humiliative, and I think American politicians, they forget that Iranians, due to thousands of years of civilization and history, they are a very proud nation. And they really cannot and do not tolerate such a language. Therefore, the type of dialogue we have on diplomacy is really problematic. And as long as the U.S. Language statements, position on Iran and Iranian nation is not respective, I don't believe anybody in Iran would be ready to go for rapprochement. Iranians, they need to be respected. The other element is the international rules and regulations. The U.S. has been inviting Iran for decades to be a member of international community. What it does mean, we have to discuss for 2-3 hours, what does mean to be a member of international community. But today we have an example which makes it very much easy to discuss. This is the nuclear issue. From the international point of view, to be member of international community, Iran should be committed to a non-proliferation treaty, NPT, on the nuclear issue. Because internationally, we don't have anything other than NPT as international consensus on nuclear program. This is the only major treaty we have. Therefore, inviting Iran to be member of international community when we are talking about the nuclear would mean and should mean that Iran should be fully committed with non-proliferation treaty. For the first time after 35 years, we have very serious, high-level, direct talks between Iranian and American foreign ministers on one of the most critical issues, nuclear. One-year experience of direct talks at very, very high level has proved that the U.S. really does not mean NPT. They have agreed, and NPT would be the framework. The Joint Plan of Action signed in November 2013 makes it very clear that the framework of a deal would be based on non-proliferation treaty, NPT. Within NPT, you have three arrangements. I just named the arrangements. I do not discuss the details because this is too much technical. The first arrangement is called Safeguard Agreement. This is mandatory. For every member of NPT, it is mandatory. But we have two other arrangements. The first one called Additional Protocol. The second one called Subsidiary Arrangement Code 3.1. These two arrangements are voluntary. The countries are not obliged. All these three arrangements is just about transparency. The level of giving access to the IAEA, International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors, to visit your nuclear program. If any country is committed to all these three arrangements, that country would be the most transparent country in the world based on NPT. Internationally, within NPT, there is nothing beyond these three arrangements. 120 countries, they have accepted to be member of the two voluntary arrangements, Additional Protocol and Subsidiary Arrangement Code 3.1. 80 countries, still they have not accepted to be member because it is not mandatory. Because it would give intrusive, this would give access for intrusive inspections to the IAEA. Even the IAEA would be able to go to your military sites. That's why 80 countries, they are still hesitant to be member of this. After a year of talk, this is completely clear for the US and the for the world powers that within a final deal, Iran would be ready to be committed to all three arrangements. And Iran would be among the most transparent nations. And Iran would be committed to transparency on its nuclear program at the maximum level of international protocols and arrangements. But why they cannot make a deal? Because all they are talking during last 6, 7, 8 months is all measures the U.S. is asking Iran, which are they are all beyond NPT. For example, we have two enrichment sites in Iran. One is at Natanz, one at Fordow. When the U.S. publicly, officially announced that all options are on the table, and they may go with Israelis to attack Iranian military, Iranian nuclear facilities, then Iran decided to build a second enrichment facility under the mountain, 100% to be immune from any military strike. Today, on the negotiation tables, the U.S. delegation is telling the Iranians, you should shut down Fordow. Iranians, they say, why? Americans, they say, because we cannot attack. We have all options on the table, and we should be able to attack whenever we want. Based on NPT, you can have 100 enrichment sites. There is no limit. That's why other countries like France, Russia, they have multiple enrichment sites. Or there is another facility, heavy water, at a city called Arak. The Americans, they tell Iranians that either you should close, you should not have heavy water facility, or you should make technical conversions to bring it to a light water. Of course, this is confidence building measures, but this is beyond NPT. Based on NPT, every country can have heavy water facility, and many member states of NPT, they have already heavy water facility. I don't want to go to details, but you may want to know with this explanation whether there would be a chance for nuclear deal or not. I would say yes, there is a good chance. And there is historic opportunity because measures within NPT are not disputed. Therefore, the U.S. demand for Iran to be committed to the maximum level of transparency within NPT is already agreed. And if there is a deal, Iran would be committed to all arrangements within NPT. Iranians, they have shown flexibility. It is not just due to recent talks from the time 2003 to 2005, which I was also member of nuclear negotiation team and the spokesperson of the team. We made the same proposal to Europeans, which that time they were our interlocutors. On Iraq, the heavy water, Iran has accepted, if there is a final deal, would make technical conversions to bring plutonium production from 10 kilogram to 1 kilogram. For a bomb, you need 10 kilogram. If you produce 1 kilogram per year, if any country decides to make nuclear bomb from a heavy water facility, would need to have 10 kilogram and reprocessing. Iranians, they are ready to have no reprocessing and limit their production to less than 1 kilogram, which would be 10 years. They would be ready to have Fordow not as enrichment site, as R&D site. I can say on confidence building measures, the US is reiterating almost 80%, 85%, they are done. Therefore, the measures within NPT, there is no dispute left. And measures even beyond NPT as confidence building measures for a specific period, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, also there is a big part already agreed. What is left is about practical needs of Iran. In November 2013, Joint Plan of Action, they agreed the size, the capacity of uranium enrichment would be synchronized to its practical needs. Iran has one nuclear power plant at Bushehr. It's working. Iran has a contract with Russia providing fuel for Bushehr. The contract would be terminated 2021. Iranians are ready to put all limits on their enrichment capacity till 2021 because they are going to get the fuel from Russia. But after 2021, when the contract with Russia is over, they want to produce their own fuel for Bushehr. Here, the U.S. is pushing Iran, although you have capacity, you have facility, you have invested, you have technology, you have engineers, you have employees, stop and continue to buy from Russia for another 10, 15 years. This is something which they are negotiating how to resolve, and I think there would be a way to get through. Number six factor is focusing on the disputed issues for over three decades. Obviously, Iran and the US, they have substantial disputes on some issues like peace process, Israel, terrorism, weapons of mass destruction, no doubt. But they have major commonalities. Iran and the US, they have common interest to fight against ISIS, extremism, Sunni extremism, terrorism, which now is getting over all Middle East, Africa, and Europe. And the US also now is considering the threat of ISIS as major national security threat to the US. Iran and the U.S. practically have been supporting the same governments in Baghdad, Iraq, and in Kabul, Afghanistan, because they have the same policy, they have the same interest in Iraq and in Afghanistan. If we want to name the major crisis in the Middle East, we would say Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, peace process. Peace process is out of the Iranian hand. Even the US cannot convince Netanyahu. Therefore, no one can blame Iran. In 1990s, when I was ambassador in Germany, Europeans, they were telling us, look, if you Iranian agree, tomorrow two-state solution would be signed. Thanks God, they are working for decades and they cannot convince Israelis to accept two-state solution. Therefore, everyone understands this is not something about Iran. If Netanyahu accepts, then the two-state solution would be there. On Iran, on Afghanistan and Iraq, they are in the same boat. On ISIS, extremism, they are on the same boat. They have differences on Syria. And Yemen, still, they don't know whether they are in the same boat or not. Because it is a new crisis. Houthis are enemy number one of Al-Qaeda, enemy number one of ISIS. But the US allies in the region like Saudi Arabia, they don't like Houthis. And Washington really doesn't know where to stay. Against ISIS, Al-Qaeda, with Houthis, in Iranian boat, or to stay with its own allies, which they are the backbone of Al-Qaeda and extremists. On Syria, I think the US is coming little by little to understand that made a big, big mistake at the beginning of Syrian crisis saying Assad must go. Now they understand Assad is better than all other alternatives. And Assad at least is secular. And the others, whatever version and names they have, Al-Qaeda, Jabhat al-Nusra, or whatever name they have, they are all fundamentalists. And the U.S. supported the fundamentalists for years, 3-4 years, hoping that they would be able to bring regime change in Syria. Now they understand this is not the case. Assad is going to stay there. And definitely these fundamentalists are not a good option for the U.S. succeeding Assad. But I would say there is a chance for Iran and the U.S. to negotiate on Syria to find a satisfactory solution, although they have differences. I would say on ISIS, extremism, terrorism, Afghanistan, Iraq, they are in the same boat with common interest. There are other issues like fighting drug trafficking in the Middle East from Afghanistan, which they have really common interest, organized crimes. There are a lot of other issues. But the problem with U.S. strategy on Iran during last 3 decades is that they have been always and only focusing on disputed issue. I believe I have explained in my book, there is a roadmap at the end of my book, what can be the roadmap, what can be the path to peace between Iran and the U.S. One of the proposals I have made in my book is that to negotiate on disputed issues like nuclear in parallel, simultaneously, to cooperate on communalities. Because the best way to create trust, confidence building, would be to get success on communalities. This would really facilitate to get to a solution on disputed issues. And factor number 7, I have much more factors in my book, but today, because we are limited, they told me just 30 to 35 minutes, is about the U.S. perception that they only they have rights to mistrust Iran. I think mistrust is mutual. Iranians, they have their own legitimate reasons not to trust the U.S. From 1953 coup, which they removed democratically elected prime minister in Iran and installed a dictator, to 25 years supporting a dictator Shah, to 8 years supporting aggressor Saddam Hussein, to providing material and technology for Saddam Hussein to use weapons of mass destruction against Iran. Chemical weapons was used by Saddam Hussein, provided technology material provided by the U.S. 100,000 Iranians. They were either killed or injured. I think for 3,000 people killed in New York, the U.S. went to a war. You can imagine then how a nation would feel if 100,000 people, they have been killed or injured for weapons of mass destruction provided by the U.S. I think we Iranians, they need to recognize the fact that Americans, they have their own reasons not to trust Iran because of many issues like hostage taking, and we have other issues. And Americans also, they need to recognize Iranians, they have their own narratives, stories, legitimate reasons not to trust the U.S. If they both recognize the mistrust is mutual, then they would begin to work to create a mutual trust and confidence. Thank you. Thank you.
Who's collecting the questions?
Am I on time, Mac?
You're doing great. I'm very impressed.
How about this? Has the U.S., has our policy sanctions against Iran, has that hurt the average Iranian? Has it been effective?
Yes. Definitely, the U.S. sanction has harmed the average low-class people. The rich, they have benefited the sanctions. Some governmental institutions, definitely, they have benefited the sanctions. But since 2006, at least, the major objective of the U.S. imposing sanction on Iran was the nuclear issue. If you talk today to majority of Congress members, they would tell you it was only the sanctions brought Iran to the negotiation table. And I am really surprised. You have heard from White House, you have heard from State Department, you have heard from the Congress, you read many articles. Sanctions brought Iran to show flexibility on the nuclear. The reason I'm surprised, I really don't know, this is because of lack of information, or they are misleading themselves to justify their wrong policy. The deal was signed in November 2013. If you read the deal, you would see this is the exact elements and principles we proposed in 2005 before sanctions. During President Khatami, in March 2005, I was member of the nuclear team. We proposed a package. The U.S. declined the package and said Iran should not have enrichment at all. In 2013, after 7 years of draconian sanctions, unilateral, multilateral, UN, U.S., EU, everything, the U.S. signed the same deal we proposed in 2005. One. Second, they imposed a sanction to contain Iranian nuclear program. Sanctions began 2006. It is not difficult to read the IAEA reports. Before sanctions, Iran was enriching to 3.5%. After sanctions, Iran increased the enrichment to 20% level. Before sanctions, Iran had one enrichment site. After sanctions, two. Before sanctions, Iran had a few hundred kilograms of enriched uranium stockpile. After sanctions, 8,000, 9,000 kilograms. Before sanctions, Iran was not able to produce fuel rods for Tehran Research Reactor built by the U.S. After sanctions, they made the fuel rod. Before sanctions, they had about 3,000 centrifuges. After sanctions, they have today 22,000 centrifuges. These figures are just published by the IAEA. And it shows sanctions hurt back the Iranian nation, but expanded Iranian nuclear program.
Okay, here's a follow-up. Because of the sanctions, do the Iranian people want a relationship with the United States, or does it make them so anti-American that they would be against a improvement, a rapprochement?
Of course, they are not happy with the U.S. sanctions. Of course, you would hear a lot of grievances from Iranian nation against the U.S. Because of the sanctions, no doubt about it. However, there was a public opinion about a year and a half ago after Rouhani's election, published in Iranian media, showing that 80% of Iranians, they are pro-Iran-U.S. rapprochement. And there was a poll done by University of Maryland, published just some months ago, showing that overwhelming majority of Iranians, they want peaceful nuclear technology. They don't want nuclear bomb, and they don't care about the sanctions.
Okay, how about this one? If the U.S. and Iran chose to work together openly to reduce the threat of ISIS, would that likely have a big impact on ISIS' success so far in the Middle East?
Mac, this is exactly one of my points. This was one of my points, that there is a clear common interest fighting ISIS and extremism in the Middle East. And Iran and the U.S., definitely they are in the same position. But because of the U.S. policy reiterating that we would go to further issues after the nuclear, there is no official direct contact cooperation between Iran and the U.S. on the ISIS. But practically, the U.S. is leading the air strike on ISIS, and Iran is leading the ground forces on ISIS. I mean, Iran is the key factor fighting ISIS today in the Middle East, and the U.S. is key factor on the air strike, Iranian on the ground. Therefore, whether they like it or not, practically, again, they are cooperating. One is leading the air strike, the other is leading the ground forces.
Okay, here's a question about U.S. internal policy and how that affects Iran. What effect has the U.S. Congress's invitation to Netanyahu to speak before Congress, what effect do you think that's had on our negotiations of a nuclear deal with Iran?
There is always a feeling, at least on the Iranian side, that the Israeli issue is everything for the U.S. I said as one of my points. But the Congress decision some days ago, which was practically against President Obama, is an evidence for many people in the Middle East, I don't know in the US, you should tell me, that Israeli Prime Minister for the Congress, US Congress, is more respected, more legitimate, more credible than the US President. Because when the US President is talking to Congress, immediately the majority, they say, look, we are going to invite Prime Minister Netanyahu to respond. And I think it was really a big, big damage to the credibility of U.S. in the mindset of Iranians that, look, even for U.S. Congress, a foreign leader is more reliable than their own president.
We'll come back to some foreign policy questions in a moment, but here are two questions about internal stuff in Iran. This is an interesting one. I lived and worked in Iran under the Shah, this questioner writes. How would you rate the corruption of the reigning mullahs to that of the corruption under the Shah?
Corruption is there, no doubt. And this is, you would read in every Iranian newspaper every day about the corruption problem. But, and there are a lot of cases publicly. Just some days ago, the first deputy president during Ahmadinejad was sentenced to 5 years jail because of corruption. Last year, there was a big corruption case. At least one person was executed. It was billions. But you won't see MAC corruption cases on clerics. If you go and you read all corruption cases, I have never seen a big issue against clerics. Whether some clerics, they have wrong policies or right policies, this is another issue. On the policies, this is another issue. But on corruption, major corruption cases, which is openly discussed in Iranian public opinion every day, I have not seen about mullahs, as he says, or clerics.
All right, how about this one? Does the Iranian government, the Rouhani government, represent the consensus of the Iranian people, or does the religious establishment, the mullahs, hold the ultimate power? Who's in charge?
See, this is a very good question. The power structure in Iran is very similar to the power structure in the U.S. We have a parliament similar to U.S. Congress, normally against the government, not this government, even the previous one, Ahmadinejad. But certainly the Iranian parliament does not respect a foreign leader's compared to their own leader. This is a big difference. But we have distinction between judiciary, administration, and parliament. Judiciary is independent. Parliament is independent. By the way, by Iranian constitution, there is no power to dissolve parliament. No one can dissolve Iranian parliament. It's one of the exceptional constitutions, because in many, many countries, there is a way to dissolve parliament. Supreme leader definitely is ultimate decision maker based on the constitution. But there is a big, big misunderstanding in the public opinion, even for the US politicians, understanding this clause of Iranian constitution. They think if the leader is ultimate decision maker, it means there is one decision maker, dictatorship, nobody else has no power. It is not really the case. Look at foreign nuclear policy. Huge differences in nuclear policy during President Khatami with the period of President Ahmadinejad. Everyone can understand the differences of a nuclear policy during two presidents with the same leader. If it was going to be the leader to impose its own policy, you should not see different nuclear policies. One even implemented additional protocol during all time, even suspended enrichment for a period as a confidence building measures. The other even defied the UN resolutions and IAEA resolutions. Decisions on major political security issues are made in Supreme National Security Council, like the US. You have National Security Council, and the National Security Council has supremacy even over State Department. That's why many, many diplomats in the State Department always here are complaining about the NSC and White House overruling their decisions, their policies. This is the same in Iran. Over there, there is the head of judiciary, head of parliament, head of the president is chairing the National Security Council, foreign minister, intelligence minister, defense minister, key figures are there. If you read my book, I have explained during the existence of Iranian constitution after revolution The Iranian supreme leader has vetoed very, very rarely 1%, 2%, 3% of the decisions of National Security Council, although he may have not been agreed with 50% of the decisions. Like today, you have heard, I'm sure you have heard, that he has frequently mentioned to the public during the last 2 years, I do not trust the US. I'm not optimistic that there would be any outcome. I don't like negotiation with the US, but because the administration wants, I have no objection. And he permitted Ahmadinejad, he permitted Rouhani to go for direct talks. If he was going to decide himself, he would have rejected. But because the National Security Council proposed and decided, he is not vetoing. That's why this is not really the case that because there is ultimate decision maker, there is no other institution or authorities in Iran to decide.
Okay, here's a follow-up question, and it starts by referring to the fact that you mentioned how stable Iran was. What do you see happening to internal Iranian politics after the current supreme leader dies?
It was the same question when Ayatollah Khomeini, 1980s, you remember, and he was even more charismatic figure. And we really couldn't imagine what's going to happen after him. Even Rafsanjani, even Ayatollah Khamenei, everybody went to him and they were asking him, how about after you? Even at the highest level, it was the question. But when Ayatollah Khomeini died, the assembly of experts decided on the next leader within 48 hours. And I believe that would be the same case. We have assembly of experts elected by the people. Each 8 years, the people, they elect assembly of experts who is responsible to nominate leader. And assembly is there, they can decide immediately.
Okay, we've got two questions. We're running out of time. We've got two sort of related questions. They're about foreign policy between what might be Iran's two great Satans of today, and that is Saudi Arabia, a strong U.S. ally. Do you consider Saudi Arabia and Iran ever able to get back together again? And not that they ever were together before, to find some rapprochement. And the second one relates to Israel. Do you ever see a close relationship developing between Iran and Israel the way it was under the Shah?
On the first one, I think there is a way to resolve Iran-Saudi problems. And I was just explaining this morning for Mac story in mid-1990s, I was missioned personally as a special envoy of president. I visited Saudi Arabia. I had 3-4 rounds of confidential long discussion with King Abdullah, who died just some days ago. And we agreed on a comprehensive package to revive Iran-Saudi relations in 1996. And the package worked for 10 years until 2005, which Ahmadinejad came to power. We had excellent relation between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Everything was just fantastic. No tension, no problem. To me, Mac, the region needs, in the Persian Gulf, which 40% of the energy is passing through this Gulf, we need a regional cooperation system between Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and 5 other GCC members around the Persian Gulf. For regional peace, security, stability. As long as there is not a regional cooperation system and a structure, we would have the countries fighting over their interests. If, like EU, I mean, you remember Europeans, they created two world wars. I don't believe Iran-Saudi Arabia hostility is more than France, Germany, UK, Germany 40, 50 years ago. But since they were able to create a regional cooperation system in Europe, nobody fears Germany or imagine there would be a third world war. Everybody is comfortable on economic issue, cultural issue, security issues. We need such a regional cooperation system for the Persian Gulf, and three pillars should be and would be Iran, Saudi Arabia, Iraq. And as long as I think the U.S. should support it, and if the U.S. push for it, Iran is ready, Iraq is ready. Some small members of GCC like Oman, they are ready. And if the U.S. pushes, I believe the U.S. would be able to convince Saudi Arabia easily, and we would be able to make it.
How about Israel?
Israel, as long as hostilities goes between, continues between Iran and the U.S., I think there would be no chance to discuss Israel at all. From Iranian point of view, the national security threat number one for Iran is the U.S. Iranians do not believe and they don't care about Israel. And they don't count on Israel as a threat because they feel they are big, powerful enough to address any Israeli. But when it comes to the U.S., this is different. Iran practically is surrounded by U.S. military. If there is rapprochement between Iran and the U.S., then you can imagine Iranian position on Israel would be modified within the Organization of Islamic Countries. Because we have Organization of Islamic Countries. And then I can assume after Iran-U.S. rapprochement, then Iranian, they would modify their position to put it in the framework of Islamic organization, which still 50 of them, they do not recognize Israel, but it is not as bad as Iran-Israel.
Okay, well, on that reasonably optimistic note, I'm talking about the rapprochement that's down the road between Iran and U.S. We'll have to wrap it up. And Hossein, we're delighted to present you with what is, I'm sure you've heard, the world-famous Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations mug.
Thank you very much. I would take it for my son, Muhammad, at Princeton University because he is a big coffee.
Okay, good.
Thank you. Thank you.
And we'll get you back. We'll get you back this summer to talk about the other side of the coin.
Thank you very much. Thank you.